Welcome to the Forum from the BBC World Service with me, Bridget Kendall. A fierce and powerful woman, mounted on a chariot and brandishing a spear with her hair streaming out behind her. It's an image of a warrior queen that's familiar to cultures in various parts of the world, and here in Britain, it instantly conjures up the figure of Boudica, also known as Boadicea. Nearly 2,000 years ago, Queen Boudica of the Iceni tribe of the east of England led a revolt against Roman invaders and almost sent them packing, till her army was overwhelmed by their superior military might. And she's still an icon. You'll find her statue nearby the British Houses of Parliament in London, still standing guard against foreign invaders. But she's also a shadowy figure. Through the ages, she's been cast as a symbol of barbarian violence, of female victimhood, an early feminist, and even a champion of British colonial might. And we know remarkably little about her, except for the accounts from two Roman historians who wrote about her several hundred years after her extraordinary uprising. One historian, Cassius Dio, or Dio, gives us the only physical description we have of Boudica.
In stature, she was very tall, in appearance most terrifying, in the glance of her eye most fierce, and her voice was harsh. A great mass of the tawniest hair fell to her hips. Around her neck was a large golden necklace, and she wore a tunic of diverse colours, over which a thick mantle was fastened with a brooch. This was her invariable attire. She now grasped a spear to aid her in terrifying all beholders and spoke.
So who was Boudica? And how did she manage to take on the Romans? And why does she still have an almost mythical status 2,000 years on? Today on the Forum, I'm joined by three experts ready to share their knowledge with you. In Southampton in the UK is the archaeologist Professor Richard Hingley. In Newcastle, here in the UK, is history, classics and archaeology lecturer Dr. Jane Webster. And here with me in Broadcasting House in London is the historian and archaeologist Emeritus Professor Miranda Aldhouse Green. Welcome to all three of you. And can I start by asking each of you, briefly please, to tell us why you think Boudica is so important? Why should we be so interested in a woman we know so little about and who lived so long ago? Miranda.
She is an iconic figure because she was one of the very few women to take on the might of Rome. And she's vastly important because she was around and active around about 20 years after the initial invasion of Britain by the Romans in AD 43. And in AD 60, she led a rebellion against the Romans, which nearly cost the then Emperor Nero the province. And the description that you have heard from Dio Cassius says quite a lot about the Romans and about Boudica, more about the Romans, really, because what they're describing is the very antithesis of Roman womanhood. This is a huge woman. Roman women were small. Red hair. Most Roman women had dark hair. She has a harsh, almost male voice. So she's depicted by Dio as somebody who is beyond the pale, beyond civilization, and all the more frightening for that.
Richard, what's your view?
I agree with Miranda's points, but I also fascinated by the legacy that Boudica has through the ages. It's partly because we know so little about her as a historical and archaeological figure that stories are elaborated around her example and her deeds in the centuries after the Renaissance, particularly, so after the 16th century. And she's a very flexible and ambiguous figure who can represent very many different things to different people, as you mentioned in the introduction. And to me, those things are certainly equally fascinating in relation to the knowledge we have of her as an ancient figure.
Jane, what about you?
I think Boudica is a really good example of why it is that certain rebellions against Rome stay in the historical record. And partly it is because she was a woman. Women leaders offended Roman sensibilities. It wasn't the order of things. But that means we know a great deal more about this rebellion than we do about many others under Rome. And for that reason alone, I think Boudicca is a really good example. The sources we have for her are not particularly detailed, and they contradict each other very often. But she has remained in the literature and persisted as a fine example of a rebel.
We'll unpick all these points as we go through the programme, but let's start by sketching in what first century Iron Age Britain was like when Boudicca staged her rebellion, as we heard, around 60 AD. Miranda, the first thing to understand is that Britain was under Roman occupation, as you said. Just explain when the Romans arrived and why they wanted to stay.
The Romans first arrived with Julius Caesar in 55 and 54 BC. When he was governor of Gaul next door, present-day France, who was a fairly egotistical person who wished to become a dictator, and he thought that if he could conquer Britain, which was regarded as a semi-mythical place, the Romans weren't even sure that Britain really existed, and if it did exist, whether the people there were actually human or not. So it was a great big thing for Julius Caesar to cross the ocean and go to Britain. He didn't stay very long in 55-54 BC, and so in a way there was a lot of coming and going between Romans and Britons in that 100 years between Caesar and the real invasion of Britain under the Emperor Claudius in AD 43.
And that set the scene for the story that we're telling today about Boudicca. They had an army of, what, 40,000? They set up governance around the area of Britain which they occupied?
Yes, they did. We have to remember that we're not talking about the whole of what we call Britain. We're talking about a few southeastern tribes, about six or seven tribes around about in East Anglia, around London to the south, and as far as Oxfordshire and just beyond. So it's by no means the whole of what we call Britain today.
And Richard, how did Boudicca and her Iceni people fit into this? What were their relations with the Romans?
We suspect when Claudius comes into Britain in AD 43 that whoever was in charge of their kingdom or their tribe made an alliance with the Romans. I'd just like to mention something that I think is important, which comes out of Miranda's comments already, but I'd like to emphasise it. Britain at this stage is not a united whole. In fact, Britain, you know, is a Roman creation, really. The people of Britain are very, very isolated. They're in small groups, and they cooperate together in some numbers to oppose the Romans. Other peoples actually side with the Romans. So these friendly kings and friendly rulers side with the Romans in helping Britain to be conquered. But Britain is not a united political state. And the Iceni are one of these groups, spread all over the southeast of Britain and also further north and west.
It's right to say, isn't it, by the middle of this century that the Iceni was seen as one of the tribes who were cooperating with the Romans. Boudicca's husband was a ruler who ruled it as Miranda called it, as a client king, as a client state, yes?
That's right. And we're also told by the classical texts that he'd ruled for some time and was very wealthy. So we might imagine that Prasutagus, if that was his name, was actually the ruler who was in charge of the Iceni when the Romans came into Britain in AD 43. But there's absolutely no evidence of that. But we do know that he was a friendly king and supportive of the actions of Rome.
And Richard, were the Roman invaders really much more sophisticated then than these Iron Age British tribes?
The classical authors certainly want us to think that, and they write very much from that perspective. I think we have to be aware that there's been a bias in a lot of approaches to the Iron Age in the past. So we have to imagine, I think it's better to imagine, that the Iron Age people have a very different culture or society, but it's not necessarily less advanced. That's a view that the Roman authors particularly place on the evidence.
Now, let's just explore a little bit more how much we know about this area. We've talked about the fact that there were Roman accounts, that there's really a dearth of quite a lot of other material, unless it's archaeological. Richard, tell us about the written histories. Who was it who wrote them, and how much do they give us about this period, and how much can we rely on it?
Tacitus, who wrote about Boudicca in two different works, and Cassius Dio, who we've heard about already. Tacitus probably came from southern Gaul And his two accounts of Boudicca don't agree in detail. I mean, they agree about the broad historical context of Boudicca's revolt, but there are differences in detail about what he has to say about the revolts. He's writing quite soon after the rebellion, and we have a reason to believe that his evidence may be more reliable, because he was a son-in-law of Agricola, and Agricola, who became later the provincial governor, was actually involved in the conflict with Boudicca. So Tacitus's accounts tend to be favoured over Cassius Dio. Cassius Dio wrote in Greek, and he was writing in probably the late 2nd century, so he was writing well over 100 years after Boudicca's rebellion. And he tends to be treated as a writer who speculated or didn't necessarily write with an idea to the accuracy of the information. Perhaps he was trying to dramatise events. And we need to be quite critical of how much of the information we're given by any of these sources we can trust.
So this is all very interesting. It just illustrates the mists swirling around the story of Boudicca. But let's hear a short passage from the history by Dio Cassius, or Cassius Dio, describing the rebellion.
A terrible disaster occurred in Britain. Two cities were sacked. 80,000 of the Romans and their allies perished, and the island was lost to Rome. Moreover, all this ruin was brought upon the Romans by a woman, a fact which in itself caused them the greatest shame.
Well, we'll come back to that idea of a woman shaming the Romans in a moment, but first let's get straight the facts, as far as we can tell, about Boudicca's rebellion. Miranda, what was the trigger that led Boudicca to take action after her husband, Prasutagus, the Iceni king, died?
Prasutagus was the client king of Rome. That relationship was entirely a personal one between an individual and the emperor. So when Prasutagus died, that relationship died with him. Now, whereas Boudicca's attitude was that she would naturally take over, the Romans had different ideas, and all that wealth that Prasutagus had had was up for grabs in terms of the Romans. And when Boudicca objected, she was flogged, which was illegal, particularly for a Roman citizen to be flogged, and her daughters apparently raped. And that shame led to the immediate spark of rebellion. But there is another factor we need to bring in, and that is the neighbouring tribe of the Trinovantes, who were to the south in Essex. They had for a long time been grumbling about the Romans. Grumbling is perhaps rather a soft word to use.
So what you're saying, Miranda, is that this just wasn't just about a personal revenge. This was much bigger social rebellion.
Boudicca's ability not just to unify the tribe of the Iceni behind her, but also the Trinovantes. This was unheard of. Most of the Britons spent a lot of time fighting each other, both within the tribe and outside. So the fact that Boudicca, if we can believe the classical sources, not only had her whole tribe behind her, but also another very large and important tribe going with her. That is, for me, really quite important, I think.
Well, let's hear what the Roman historian Tacitus had to say about Roman brutality against Boudicca and her late husband's kingdom.
Kingdom and household alike were plundered like prizes of war, the one by Roman officers, the other by Roman slaves. As a beginning, his widow Boudicca was flogged and their daughters raped. The Icenian chiefs were deprived of their hereditary estates as if the Romans had been given the whole country. The king's own relatives were treated like slaves, and the humiliated Iceni feared still worse now that they had been reduced to provincial status. So they rebelled.
It's interesting, Jane, isn't it, when you hear how Tacitus writes it. He's quite sort of sympathetic towards the Iceni in that passage.
Part of the moral message that Tacitus is writing for his readership is to suggest that Roman rule has moral consequences and that overdoing things will result in difficulties. But if you turn to Dio Cassius, his reading of why the rebellion happens is completely different. Basically, he says it's due to the debt burden that emerges when a province has been newly acquired. Emperors lend or give money to the elites that become client kings. And for some reason that's not at all clear, around this time, those debts were called in. It was said that they were no longer donations. And private citizens lent money as well. So Seneca, who was Nero's tutor, was lending money to Britons. And suddenly it was all called in. And that's the context that is given in Cassius Dio for the rise of Britain under Rome. So there are two different things, perhaps both happening at once, that we can account for here.
And so we've got to the point where Boudicca mounts an uprising. Richard, can you take us through exactly what she did, what she managed to do, and how far her uprising got?
We know from Tacitus that she started off by approaching and destroying the colony at Camalodunum, or Colchester, in eastern England. This was the most high-profile, most important Roman city in Britain at the time. She then moved on, after sacking Colchester or Camalodunum, to sack the new Roman city at London, or Londinium. Now, London was a very significant trading port at this time, and the evidence we have from excavation indicates that it was a thriving, quite extensive settlement. After this, she moves further north, and she sacks and destroys another very high-profile Roman city at Verulamium, or St Albans, just north of London. And these three places, Camalodunum, Londinium and Verulamium, are the three most important Roman urban centres or cities in Britain at the time. She seems to be going deliberately for high status and politically and militarily important locations in her actions to defeat the Romans and drive them out of the province.
It is an amazing story, isn't it? It must have been astonishing for the Romans. And then it was a woman, military leader, who was sacking these towns. We mentioned earlier that the Roman historian Cassius Dio said the Romans felt shamed by the fact that a woman came so close to throwing them out of Britain. Do you think, Miranda, that this is why she became so famous or infamous, that the Romans were shocked by being defied by a woman warrior?
I think so. And it's interesting just to look sideways for a moment and look at other women who did the same thing and were equally regarded as absolutely beyond the pale. We need only think about Cleopatra, who managed to seduce both Julius Caesar and Mark Antony and, again, tried to bring Rome to its knees. The idea that a woman could have this kind of influence on Rome at the highest level was regarded as absolutely appalling. And, you know, one can't emphasise that too strongly. So the idea that a mere woman, not only a woman, but a Briton, an uncivilised barbarian, some of the Greek writers, like Herodian, for example, thought the Britons had tails and waded in the mud and went naked and the whole of Britain was submerged in mud. I mean, these were people who thought Britannia was just, you know, hardly worth thinking about.
And Jane, do you think the description of her that we had at the start of the programme, tall and red-haired and terrifying, do you think that probably was accurate?
I think it plays to what was already known about the appearance of Britons by Rome. And certainly the mention of her wearing a necklace or torque can be verified archaeologically. One of the best hoards of these very large necklaces we have actually comes from Iceni territory. It's called the Snettisham Hoard, and it dates to about the 70s BC. So there are aspects of her appearance that would already have been well known, and of her jewellery as well would have been well known to people who had spent time in Britain.
And you said, Jane, that there were other rebellions against the Romans, perhaps less attention paid to them because they weren't led by women. But there were also other women warrior leaders among the British tribes, right?
Well, there was Cartimandua, who is in a different position because she was very pro-Roman. I think it is the gender of Boudicca that keeps her rebellion in the Roman mind, the same as it was for Cleopatra and would be two centuries later for Zenobia in Syria. Women who stand up against Rome stand out, and therefore their actions are recorded in more than one history.
Miranda?
One thing that I think we need to do is to put the whole women thing into a bit more context, because one of the interesting things about Britain is that in the Iron Age, the Middle Iron Age, for example, there is quite a lot of evidence for important independent females in terms of their burials. We have, for example, in Yorkshire, a number of so-called chariot or cart burials dating to the Middle Iron Age, which I'm talking about 4th, 3rd century BC, where there are some female graves that are remarkably rich. And sometimes they are accompanied by male burials, sometimes they're on their own. So they're not just somebody's wife, they're on their own, and they are clearly important.
This is also the year that the Boudiccan rebellion breaks out is also the year that Suetonius Paulinus, the military governor, is waging a battle in Wales against the Druids, who have also risen against Rome.
So, remind us who the Druids are, Jane.
The Druids are the religious elite of Britain. So we've talked quite a lot about the aristocracy, but alongside them was a very powerful religious elite, kind of extra-tribal across the whole of Britain, who were responsible for divination and religious rituals and, according to the Romans, sacrifice and so on. And they're a good example of another kind of elite who, after some time under Rome, feels threatened for one reason or another, and they rise against the Romans. And clearly Suetonius has to go off to Mona or Anglesey in Wales and attempt to defeat them. This is also written about by Tacitus. And it's interesting that these two things are happening in the same year. It's very likely that Boudicca realised that if she was going to make a stand, then in this year where the army was already distracted, it would be a good time to do it.
Now, I wonder to what extent, you know, these places are spiritually really important in the late Iron Age. The Romans come in, they build Mediterranean-style cities, or they start setting about building Mediterranean-style cities at these locations. And is Boudicca actually, to an extent, trying to put them back by burning these places down to the status they have in the late Iron Age? Were they the sort of places that we might expect people to be really feeling a strong connection with the spirits, and hence perhaps the Druids go deeper in the story, and Boudicca's policy in the actions she takes are partly to actually follow up some of these spiritual connections, so that her war is actually a religious war as much as a sort of territorial, a political war?
Absolutely fascinating. So far we've heard about the Roman conquest and how Boudicca was betrayed and rebelled, and a possible Druid connection. But let's look a bit more closely at her as a warrior leader and the final battle which led to her demise. Richard, how close do you think she really was to kicking the Romans out of Britain? How much of a shock did they get?
The classical writers suggest that she came very close to doing it, but we've talked already about how reliable those might be. I think when we come to thinking about the aftermath of the rebellion, we're now getting some evidence of the scale of the Roman military response to re-establish the province. And I think we have to be aware of how much of a really dramatic political defeat it would have been if the Romans had accepted being driven out of Britain. I tend to think that she certainly gave them a very deep shock, and she certainly killed a lot of people, but the chances are that the Romans were always going to come back and punish the people who'd rebelled against them.
But Miranda, the governor, the Roman governor, staged a tactical retreat, didn't he, when she advanced on London and St Albans? He decided not to defend those Roman cities.
That's right. I mean, London was a prime example. He said anybody who can come with the legions will save, but everybody, the old, the disabled, the children, we have to leave. And, you know, that was a really big decision for him to make.
Well, after the fall of London and what was to become St Albans, the Roman governor did decide to rally his forces in order to confront Boudicca. And let's hear another passage from the Roman historian Tacitus, a description of the speech she gave in the run-up to that final battle.
Boudicca drove round all the tribes in a chariot, with her daughters in front of her. "We British are used to woman commanders in war," she cried. "I am descended from mighty men. But now I am not fighting for my kingdom and wealth. I am fighting as an ordinary person for my lost freedom, my bruised body, and my outraged daughters. The gods will grant the vengeance we deserve.
It's a terrific speech, isn't it? Inspirational. Though, Jane, we have to remember this is coming to us through Tacitus, who's a marvellous writer. But it does sound as though she was an inspirational leader.
Well, that speech is, of course, made up by Tacitus. And one of the things he's trying to do in the speech is to dig at the then emperor, Nero. As the speech goes on, and some of the things she says, the aim of the speech is to suggest that she is actually more of a man than Nero is. So we have to take these speeches with a considerable pinch of salt, I think.
It's always the case with political speeches, isn't it? Think of the domestic audience. But Richard, when it came to that final battle, the story is that her British tribes were, in the end, though there were many more of them, they were no match for the better trained and skilled and well-armed Roman troops. Where do we think this battle was held?
We have very little evidence to locate the battle. If we could locate Boudicca's final battle site, it would certainly help us a lot to think about the policies and strategies followed by both the Britons and the Romans. But at the moment, that's just something that we could wish for, and perhaps one day it will happen.
Let's come on to what happened to Boudicca herself. So her army's been routed. Her undisciplined, ill-equipped army against the Roman legions finds that it's not a match for them when they have to confront them. What happens to Boudicca, Richard? What do we know? What do we think happened?
We're told two different things. We're told by Tacitus that she took poison, and we're told by Cassius Dio that she was killed and had a lavish burial. One of the things is that we really don't know what happened to her, and we wouldn't expect her to have a lavish burial if her burial was undertaken by her own people, because unlike quite a lot of the rest of southeastern Britain, we don't have a strong tradition of high-status late Iron Age burials in the territory of the Iceni. So if she came from the Iceni and she was the leader of the Iceni, we would really think that Cassius Dio was wrong and she wasn't buried in state, effectively. But whether she was killed in the battle or, as Tacitus tells us, took poison, we are confident she didn't survive the battle, at least.
And the thing is about the lavish burial, the Romans wouldn't have allowed that because it could be a place of pilgrimage.
Still to be located. But the point is that after she died and after the rebellion ended, she did seem to be somewhat effaced from history, except in popular culture, in by-the-way references. But it wasn't until the accounts by Tacitus and Cassius Dio came along that something was formulated, which is a description of what happened. But it wasn't until much later, that in the Renaissance, that she came back as a figure who people took account of. Let's leap forward to a point when she has political resonance again in a very obvious way, which is during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. Miranda.
Well, of course, Elizabeth is a queen in a man's world, a very important, powerful woman. And perhaps what's also quite interesting is that she also has bright red hair. So there is this link, and we're talking about a period of time when people were beginning to get interested in a remote past for Britain, to give Britain a pedigree and a long antiquity. So this is at a time when classical writers are being rediscovered for the first time.
We're talking about the 16th century.
We're talking about the 16th century. So Boudicca is basically resurrected.
People are beginning to read Tacitus.
They are. They're beginning to read Caesar. They're beginning to read Tacitus and other classical writers. But marching alongside a renewed interest in people like Boudicca is a renewed interest in the Druids. And they march side by side.
Probably no accident in that context that one of the many places that Boudicca is suggested to be buried is at Stonehenge.
Let's hear part of a poem by the Victorian British poet Francis Barker, written in 1859, entitled Boadicea. This is Boudicca making an impassioned speech to the assembled tribesmen.
Men, Britons, fathers, I appeal to you, for yourselves, your wives, your children, and for the honour of our common country. I call upon you all to arouse yourself and struggle for freedom to the death. Soon, soon then will you enjoy the palm of victory, and your children and your children's children will bless you as they boast themselves the offspring of the free.
There you are, the offspring of the free, the rebel. It's very florid, isn't it? Nationalistic, speechifying. Richard, I suppose it would have appealed to Victorian England at the height of its imperial powers.
Yes, Boudicca's reinvented effectively as a figurehead of imperialism in the Victorian period. And I should say that there are people who are quite critical of Boudicca at the same time. So we can't assume that her interpretation, her reception is simple at any stage since the Renaissance, but
critical of her as someone who was herself ruthless.
Well, somebody who's barbaric. We have these two sides of Boudicca, which are always in opposition to each other. So Victorian imperialists didn't tend to like the idea of armed conflict with people, particularly uprisings and rebellions, because there were rebellions occurring against the British. And Boudicca in that way is quite problematic to the British, but the dominant interpretation really throughout the 19th century is a very positive one of Boudicca, that she is a British rebel. And being British, she is better than other rebels who might be rebelling against the British, because the British very much convince themselves that they're offering these opportunities to people in other parts of the world, and they've got an ethical superiority against the dictatorial militaristic Romans. Now, we think very differently today. Obviously, we think very critically of these nationalistic and imperialistic images of Boudicca. They were part of what I call imperial discourse.
So was she a freedom fighter or a terrorist? That's the nub of it.
Yes, yes. I mean, she could be both.
Miranda, you talked about the way her image is two sides of the coin, but there's another way in which it's two sides of the coin, isn't it? Is she an icon of victimhood, a wronged mother seeking revenge for herself and her daughters? Or is she the prototype of the empowered woman, the early feminist, capable herself of being brutal and cruel if she needs to? Because she was a role model for the suffragettes who were campaigning for votes for women at a certain point too, wasn't she?
Yes, absolutely. I don't like the victimhood idea. I think she overcame that and is much more three-dimensional or colourful as an early feminist who was not only taking on the might of Rome, but taking on the kind of male role of being an army commander, able to rally large numbers of rather disparate Britons behind her. So I think that's the way that she would like to be remembered and the way that I think she should be remembered.
And I suppose we should also make the point that the image of Boudicca is, if anything, even more resonant in contemporary popular culture. Certainly in this country, I'd say more people are familiar with the name of Boudicca than used to be in my memory as a child. Jane, this is about the increase of attention being paid these days to women leaders throughout history, surely, isn't it?
I think that's true. There has been a strong surge of interest through the classical sources and through later historiography in rebellious women and in women who have taken on leadership roles. I mean, Boudicca, for all she led a raggle-taggle army, destroyed a vexillation. That's 1,000 troops from a Roman legion. That's pretty significant.
And Miranda, I guess the other way in which she resonates with us is throughout the world, rebellions by underdogs. This is also a way in which she seems a contemporary figure.
Yes, I mean, Britain itself was an underdog. And she herself was a woman with an underdog. And she was on the periphery, she was on the outer rim. So in every way, she was beyond civilization, beyond the pale. And the Romans didn't see her coming. And it was a shock, and it was a horror, and it turned the Roman Empire upside down. And I really don't think we can overemphasize how Nero really thought about whether Britain was worth the candle, and he could easily have decided to leave it alone.
I said at the start of the programme that there have been women warrior leaders in many countries and many popular histories. I just wondered, the three of you, which are the female leaders in different parts of the world, warriors, who you would remember and single out? Jane, you mentioned Queen Zenobia, didn't you?
Yes, I think as a classical example, Zenobia is a fine case of a woman who today is a national hero in Syria. But I think it's a more modern example.
So let's just remind people who she was. This is Queen Zenobia of 3rd century, what is now modern-day Syria.
Modern-day Syria, yeah.
The Palmyran Empire.
Yeah, she led a rebellion against Rome.
But you said there's a more modern example.
Yeah, my modern example, actually, I was thinking about who I would see as a modern-day Boadicea, and I would think I would pick Jaya Bendesai, who was born in Gujarat, grew up in Tanzania, and then came to England and led in London the Grunwick factory strike in the 1970s. And that was a fight against a different kind of authority and a fight to establish workers' rights. But she's there for me in that same place as Boadicea.
What about you, Miranda? Have you given this anything?
Well, I think Cleopatra for me in the ancient world. And I would choose any one of the suffragettes, Emily Davidson perhaps, as my more modern example of somebody who really, really kicked over the traces and had the guts and the courage just to overturn the status quo.
Richard, what about you?
Well, I go back to the suffragists again, and Cicely Hamilton created a pageant in 1910 called A Pageant of Great Women, and basically this was an attempt to answer certain male views of what women were trying to do at this stage to get the vote. And Cicely Hamilton actually put together a range of great women from the past, and some of them are British or European. One of the women she quotes is the Rani of Jhansi. Now, the Rani of Jhansi was an Indian leader, a female leader, who was very deeply involved in the Indian uprising, or as the British called it, the Indian Mutiny. And she led resistance for some time against the Britons and was killed in 1858. And I find it really interesting in 1910 that Cicely Hamilton and the people who were helping her to create this pageant actually took the Rani of Jhansi largely as a positive figure, not a critical figure. We're still in 1910 in a period in which the British Empire is a very dominant world force. And I think, you know, it's interesting to me that Cicely Hamilton, perhaps I'm quoting two powerful women here, is actually taking the side of the Rani of Jhansi and creating her as a very positive figure alongside Boudicca.
I guess if you look even further afield around the world, it doesn't take very long in many places to find either warrior queens or strong leaders who are women, who are still remembered by their cultures. As Yenenga, the warrior daughter of the 12th century king in what is now modern day Ghana. There's Princess Pingyang at the end of the Sui dynasty in China, who raised an army known as the Army of the Lady. There's Queen Olga of Kiev, who lived in 10th century Kiev and both obliterated her husband's enemies and converted her people to Christianity. And in modern-day Arizona, there's the 19th century Apache warrior and prophetess Lozen. So what this seems to say to us, Miranda, is that there have always been these women warrior leaders or queens. And we remember them because at the same time that they've always been there, we do, in many parts of the world, they are seen as a little bit extraordinary.
They are. And the interesting thing, and the further back in time you go, the more interesting it is, that these women's names are remembered. There are countless male warriors and leaders whose names have passed into oblivion, whereas the women are remembered, their names are remembered, and so they come down to us as very rounded people who are as alive today in memory as they were when they were striding around with their spears cutting off people's heads.
Well, certainly Boudicca, as the result of this programme, feels very alive, even though, as we've said, there are a paucity of resources, either written or archaeological. So we have to give credit to those Roman historians too for painting a picture of her, an image that's still with us today. Mm. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. Many thanks to you all. This has been a wonderful programme, so interesting. Professors Richard Hingley and Miranda Aldhouse Green and Dr. Jane Webster. Do listen to our other programmes. You can find them all on our website or as podcasts. But for now, from me, Bridget Kendall, and all of us on the Forum team, goodbye.